This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It's July 12th, 2017. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, the lovely Fran Storch.
Hi!
That's Fran. A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, you can either call or text at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook. If you want to listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk, you can listen on whus.org or on iTunes. If you want to contribute or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Enough on the business end of things. Okay, on a positive side, we're going to start out with on a positive side before the rant of the week. And on a positive side, a shout out to Saul Nesselroth, 90 years old and still riding his bicycle. He is our local old guy who rides a bike. And you would never know it when you talk to him. We had a lovely ride this past weekend with him. Everyone converged upon the Red Barn in, I guess that's in Mansfield, on Browns Road. And he bought us all ice cream. How about that? He's 90 years old. He buys us ice cream. So that was kind of a cool thing. But Saul is still out riding his bike, and he's contemplating what he's going to do about coming up with a 90-kilometer ride to help celebrate his 90th year on the planet. So big shout out to Saul Nesselroth. That's definitely a positive side. Ron's rant of the week. Oh, you guys are going to love this one. My rant of the week is against me. Yes, me.
What did you do?
I did something bad. I did something really bad.
You naughty man.
I jumped to conclusions, and I ranted last week about the whole incident with Peter Sagan and in the Tour and the elbow and all that. And after looking at footage, oh, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60 times because they kept playing it over and over and over again, I realized that he did not put his elbow into Cavendish's face. He was just lifting his arm up to get it out of the way. Otherwise, Cav would have taken him down with him. So as you look at it really, really closely, Paul Sherwin was going over it and over it on NBC and NBC Sports Network. And it was really obvious as they slowed it all down that that, you know, he was not at fault, and he shouldn't have been pulled out of the Tour for that. He probably should not have been. It should not have been done. And I have a guest here, which we'll get to here in a minute. And she was texting me on it, and she called it right, and the sportscasters called it right. Of course, they had the film footage to keep looking at over and over again. So a little bit in their credit, but I was wrong. So my rant of the week is on me. How about that? And also on race organizers that put incredibly difficult finishes into bicycle races, all for the sake of making it exciting for the fans. So that's another rant, maybe for another time, maybe a little more. We can have a little bit more discussion on that. I know there's been a lot of discussion, and Bob Roll was talking about, hey, they're racers. They go to a race. This is what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be prepared for this sort of thing. We'll talk about it another time. Anyway, moving forward from the rant of the week, the other thing is Andre Greipel said, sometimes I should watch images before I say something. Apologies to Peter Sagan, as I think the decision of the judge is too hard. So anyway, that's enough of that. Tour de France. Yes, the Tour de France is still going on. We are still in the 104th edition of the Tour de France. It is what today is stage 12, and it's another flat stage right now where we came out of the mountains. We're back into flat stages. There's been way too much going on in the Tour. It's being called the Tour de Crash because of all of the horrible accidents that have happened in the race. That's yet another time, another discussion, because I have a guest here, and we don't want to bore you with that. We want to talk about cool stuff. So we'll move on that one. But it is stage 12 today. They are in the flats, and there is a big sprint finish coming up, and it's if you got a chance to watch stage 11 yesterday and saw Kittel sprint away from people like they were completely standing still, I've never seen a sprint finish where the rider at the end of the Tour de France, where the rider actually has enough time and knows he has enough space that he coasts across the finish line. It was impressive. So anyway, he blew out like he was coming out of a cannon. His lead out man was amazing and just put him right in the right place. Didn't lose his cool during the chaotic finish, and it was pretty cool. So I have a special guest here today, and this special guest is her third appearance. This is very exciting. Three times now. So my special guest is Amber Pierce from Mansfield, Connecticut, of
Hello.
All places, our local resident professional bicycle racer. Amber, thank you so much for coming today.
Oh, it's great to be here again.
Yeah, it's always great to have you here. This is great. Now, you're fresh off of some lots of racing, right? You've been doing an awful lot lately.
Yeah, we're in the thick of the season right now.
Yeah, and did I see that you just came back from the U.S. Pro Nationals? Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
Yeah? How was that?
It was really hot and really muggy.
Yeah.
We were down in Knoxville, Tennessee, so that
Knoxville. Ugh.
Added a layer of challenge, but yeah.
I'll bet. And you were at the Tour of California before that, I saw?
Yep, that was earlier in the season.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so, you know, I follow you whenever I can. I try to keep my eyes on you. Where's Amber now? It's like, where's Waldo?
I know.
Where's Amber? So I know that you were down to a limited team at the Tour of California, weren't you?
Yeah, we lost a couple riders to illness and crashes earlier in the race. So we started with six, which was the most you could start in that race. And then we ended up with three, which is always difficult when you're racing against teams of full six riders.
Ouch. Yeah. Because then you end up like your position, if I'm not mistaken, I see you listed as domestique, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're one of the workers,
yes.
or what we like to call the worker bees. And so anyway, if you're not familiar with a domestique, what a domestique does everything. The domestique is there to bring your food up to you. The domestique is there for if you get a flat tire and you're one of the main contenders in your race, they put you on their wheel and they draw you back into the pack. They will help communicate with you if your race radio goes down. They I'm sure you've been put into a lot of these situations.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I just tip my hat at you. You are like, you got to work a lot harder than some of the other riders do at times.
At times, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So it's not an easy job. It's not a glorious job sometimes. It's what it is.
No, that's an interesting thing about bike racing is that it's very much a team sport. But unlike soccer or basketball, only one person on the team gets to stand on the podium. Even though every person on the team has contributed to that victory, only one person actually gets to stand up there and have the glory. But I think it's actually very fulfilling to be that person who's facilitating someone else's success.
Mm-hmm.
And in cycling, there's a lot of respect for the work that the domestiques do. And there's a lot of acknowledgement for the fact that one person, generally speaking, once you get to a high level of racing, it's really not possible to win bike races without a solid team behind you. So there's a lot of respect within the peloton for the work that's done by the domestiques on the various teams. And, you know, it takes a great deal of sacrifice, because to do that kind of work, you're sacrificing your own possibility for a result. And as much as that might seem a little bit strange from the outside, it's actually a really great feeling. And being in a team where you know that you're willing to sacrifice for somebody on a given day when, you know, they have the best chance of winning the race, that at some point in the season, maybe the roles will be reversed and they might be working for you in a situation where if I happen to get in a breakaway, I know that I'll have the support of my team behind me. So there's a really strong bond that becomes forged through that kind of mutual sacrifice. It's very unique to cycling, actually.
So has it occurred before where you're actually you're in the race and somehow you magically, mysteriously end up in the break when maybe you weren't supposed to be there?
Yeah, it's definitely happened.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden the race radio comes over and it's like, okay, change of plans. Is that how they do that?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the race. For a few years there, we weren't allowed to use radios. Mm-hmm. When I first started, radios were allowed all the time. Then they weren't allowed, and now they're allowed in some races. But generally speaking, as a team, you understand that the goal, you know before the race what the goal is. The goal might be in a stage race to preserve the lead of your GC leader, like the racers are trying to do in the Tour de France right now for their leaders, or you might be going for a stage win. And generally speaking, the goal is to the goal is for the team. So if I end up in a breakaway and, you know, we're it's advantageous for us in that it actually gives us a better statistical chance of winning the bike race. Really for the team, the goal is just to get our jersey on the podium. And if that's me, even if that wasn't the plan, if we're happy with the composition of the break and we know that that's going to give us a good chance for a win, then yeah, we have to switch the plan on the fly.
Wow. Wow. Boy, there's all sorts of questions. I could ask, we could do a whole show again on this because I just, I'm full of questions about this. It just fascinates me to no end. But you know, we won't get crazy. You know, I started to, I've been the master ceremonies and race announcer, whatever you want to call it, for Tyler's Farm to Fork Fondos.
Oh, those are great events.
Which are really cool events. And I have another one coming up this weekend, which is really cool.
Such a good way to see New England.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. So I have to wear a radio. I have to put a thing in my ear and that drives me nuts. How
really?
Do you get used to that?
I don't know. I just, it has never actually bothered me.
Oh my God. It's just annoying. It just really, I don't like it. I don't like it. And then someone talking in my ear and I'm trying to talk at the same time. And then someone's like saying, I would make a lousy CIA.
It's your attention issues. It's because, I mean, doesn't that happen to you? If you walk into a room and there are a lot of people talking, it's difficult for you to single out whoever you're listening to. Isn't that like overwhelming sensorily to you?
Yeah, because of who I am.
Right.
Yeah, because I'm that ADHD guy. Yeah. So I either have to be really focused on something or I'm everywhere. So that's just kind of the way it is. But, you know, they're good point, though. You know, we have a local cyclocross racer who has been many-time national champion, Jeremy Powers, who is very ADHD.
Hmm.
And he, I keep telling him, you need to write the book now. Write the book on how he, because he said he uses it to his advantage.
Huh.
Which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
And if I can sit down and talk to him someday, maybe I'll get him on the show. That'd be he'd be really fun to get on the show.
He'd be great.
Yeah, he'd be busy, but he'd be good. Yeah, if I could get him here, I'll try to pin him down. Because he uses his, we could do a double show with Fran's show talking about ADHD and then going to having him on. And oh boy. Oh, wheels are spinning. Anyway, moving forward, we're not here just to talk about all that stuff. We're here because we're going to talk about skills and techniques. That's kind of what you had said to me that you were looking to discuss today. So I'm going to start this out with the first question I'm going to have for you is, can you tell me your experience with your very first group ride?
I'm trying to think of what my first group ride was. I don't know for sure if this was it, but this was the first one that really stands out in memory. It was a very early one, which I did with the Stanford cycling team. So I raced collegiate racing with the Stanford team, and it was my first foray into road racing, if you will. So I was on this great old steel bike with down tube shifters, and
beautiful.
We were going to do this big adventure ride. Stanford's kind of located on a peninsula, and between the peninsula and the coast, where you can get to the beach, there's this nice north-south ridge that we would ride over to the coast and then back. So it was lots of climbing to get there and then lots of climbing to get back. And we went down this really cool kind of dirt gravel road, which was awesome. And I felt I felt really good about myself because I just felt like I was rocking this gravel. It was super cool. And then we hit the road again and it started going. And I started falling back through the group like I was a stone through water. And I couldn't hang on. And so the coach, you know, sent one by one people from the team back to try to let me draft. And so if you're listening, if you ride behind somebody, generally speaking, on a flat, you know, with no wind or still air, it's usually about 30% less work that the person behind is doing relative to the person in front. So if you have somebody in front of you, it makes it a little bit easier. So if you're really hurting, having a friend ride in front of you is a really, really nice thing. So the team was trying to do that for me, and I just kept dropping back. And so they'd drop, you know, send somebody else back. And so this was one of my first lessons in drafting. So
it's not something that you can just pick up either. It's a skill.
Yeah, it
which
is.
Which we'll
it
talk
is.
About later, but
right.
Yes.
So eventually the entire team was riding in front of me in basically a parabola formation.
Oh, nice. There you go.
Me.
They made a wall for you.
They did. And which was to help me, but it was also in their own interest as well, because it was sort of a no rider left behind ride, and they wanted to eventually get back to where we were going. So when we got to the next stop, which was where we got food, everybody was shoving bars in my face and offering me water and drinks and refuel, because I thought I was bonking, everyone thought I was bonking. And then as we started to go again, I realized my rear wheel wouldn't turn. And what was, when we were on that gravel road, my rear wheel had just kind of moved a little bit, and so it was just jammed up against the frame. So the whole time I thought I was bonking, it was actually because my rear wheel would barely turn.
So you discovered power training in a very early time. That's all. that's a beautiful thing. Oh my God, I can't imagine. Okay, second question for you. I couldn't just get by with just one question here. Your very first race experience.
Well, I actually started out by racing mountain bikes. And that was, I got talked into joining the Stanford cycling team through the mountain bike team. And the way that they sold it was, it's not really racing. It's mostly just road tripping, camping, partying all weekend. And then at some point you ride your bike, which, I mean, who's not going to want to do that, right?
It's college life.
I know. It was great. So I thought, hey, yeah, sign me up. And at that point in my life, I had just finished a long career of swimming. And I had been competing at the NC2A level for swimming as well, which was a really high-pressure situation. So I was actually pretty burned out on racing and competition, and I didn't really want much to do with it, which was why I was hesitant to join the collegiate cycling team. But after they sold me on the road trips and the parties, I thought, okay, you know.
Well, this is the way to go,
this
right?
This sounds great.
These
cyclists,
they have fun. Yeah.
So I when I started, I really had no intention of racing hard. I had no ego in it. I didn't want to have any expectations for a result. So I would just go and have fun and ride around. And I didn't do any structured training. In fact, I kind of avoided structured training because I felt like that would, for me anyway, in my own mind, if I did structured training, I would have expectations of myself. So without the structured training, I could go and race and not have expectations, because who's going to do well if you're not training, right? So
right.
It was really just mostly about that. And then eventually the road season came around and the same group said, hey, you know, come on out for the road season. It's just like mountain bike. And so, which it's not.
Not at all.
But it was the same group of really wonderful, encouraging people who were making bike racing really, really fun. And so I got into the road racing, and I kind of kept the same sense of not wanting expectations. So the races were very different than the mountain bike races, obviously, but they were fun. I was in them with my friends and my teammates, and already I had this sense of wanting to help my teammates. I had a really, this is a good one. There was one of the early criteriums that I did. I didn't know much about bike racing strategy, but all I knew was my sprinter wasn't supposed to be in the wind. So going back to that concept of drafting and having the person behind you doing less work.
Right.
You want your sprinter to be as fresh as possible for the end of the race. And so you want your sprinter to be behind somebody, you know, preferably a teammate that they can trust for most of the race, so that by the time they get to the finish, they're nice and fresh. And I remember some of the Berkeley girls were in this race, and they just kept pushing my sprinter out into the wind. Not physically pushing, but
no, but there's way, there are ways.
Yeah, positioning themselves in a way that our sprinter kept getting stuck out in the wind. And I saw that happening, and boy, I just got mad. So I just went to the front. I said to my sprinter, her name was Mary, "Mary, get on my wheel." So she got on my wheel, and I just went berserk. I mean, I didn't know anything about pacing myself. I didn't know anything about strategy. All I knew was that she wasn't supposed to be in the wind, and by golly, if I was in that race, she wasn't going to see the wind. So we just went as hard as we could, and I just sat on the front the whole race. Eventually, we dropped everybody aside from two other riders. So we had a break of four going, and then, of course, as soon as we hit the last lap, the other two girls from Cal attacked like berserk, and I was toast because I was on the front.
Oh, sure.
Wasting all that
You're
energy.
Fried. Yeah.
But I think our sprinter ended up second in that race, so I was pretty happy with that. But our coach at the time kind of took me aside afterwards, and he gave me these words of advice that are seared into my brain forever. He said, "You need to learn to ratchet the machinery of the universe in your direction."
Whoa. I don't know where to go with that. Wow. Ratchet the machinery of the universe
in your direction.
Okay. I'm going to have to write that one down and keep it. That's really interesting. So have you?
Man, I try in every race. That's the goal.
It's so hard because, you know, if you burn too many matches, you burn too many matches and you're done. That's all there is to it. I used to many years ago when I had the bicycle shop, I had a large van. They didn't have a large van up here at UConn, but they had a cycling team and they were all hanging out at the bike shop. So I would pack them all into my van. I had a couple of big racks on the roof. I could carry, you know, 8 riders with me and off we would go to the races.
Oh, awesome.
And so it was just, you know, cause I just like bike races. I think it's a cool thing. I think it's a great sport. It's got some really interesting parts to it. Anyway, so I'm dragging him off to the races, and this poor girl, really strong. I mean, we would take her out on rides, and she was solid.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a really solid rider. Well, she gets out, and she gets away in a break with 2 girls from the University of Vermont, and they proceeded to do the dance with her. And you know the dance. They would pull through and then they would get her on their wheel, and then the back rider would like slowly back off from the front rider, and then she would have to come around them to get back up because she was losing, you know, the rider in front. So she would sprint around, that second rider would then hop on her wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that it's a I've had it done to me and I have done it to people, and it is just so It destroys you. It absolutely destroys you because you're constantly having to sprint back up, and you end up doing all the work.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two are taking turns, the front and the back, you know, doing the damage. And I just watched her getting, and I'm trying to think, what can I tell her? I mean, what do you tell someone in that situation? They just got to hang in there. It's really hard, and they can't lose any wheels at all. I mean, and yet you do because it's you're drawn back away from that front wheel. So it's so hard a situation to be in. And I just watched her and you know, everybody's yelling for her. And I said, they're going to kill her. They're going to kill her at the end. She's not going to have anything left. They're just, this is what, and I'm explaining to them what's going on. So they had never seen this before. They'd never seen this technique before. You know, they're just college kids. And I'm just, you know, telling them what's going to, and of course, you know, they sprinted at the end. They got 1-2 and she got way back 3. And, you know, stayed away in the break. Good for her. But given that situation again, I don't know any way out of that one. Do you?
It's tough. There are certain things that you can do. For example, attack them and try to lose one of them, and then you're just
one. And then you only have one. Yeah.
But this is the thing about bike racing. I think is you could have sat her down before that race and explained, you know, the 5 different, 8 different, 10 different things that they might do to her should she end up in a breakaway.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, all the different techniques that might happen if a breakaway doesn't stick. I mean, there's so many things that can happen at a bike race, and sitting somebody down and trying to walk them through all of those potential eventualities, honestly, it's not really going to make a difference because you can't think about all of that when you're in the middle of the race. So what ends up happening is you kind of have to just learn through trial and error. Mm-hmm. And every time you do a bike race, you're never going to see the same situation, the exact same situation twice, but you will come across similar situations. So the more races you have under your belt, every time you race, if you can sit down and kind of debrief and break everything down with somebody afterwards, then you kind of, I like to think of it as like, you know, a Rolodex. It's a totally outdated term at this point, but it's kind of like a Rolodex of races and race scenarios in which you've found yourself. And so that when you're in a race and you see a situation evolving, you can kind of harken back to, you know, the 10 different races that had similar scenarios, and your instinct is going to kick in. And so it's all of that experience and trial and error that is what ends up honing your instinct, so that when you see a similar situation, you don't even have to think about it. You know exactly the right thing to do in that situation. So it's hard. I mean, if any time you're in a race and you're experiencing or you're facing a situation for the first time, it's really, really hard because chances are you're going to make mistakes. But the great thing about mistakes is you learn from them, and you're never going to have a perfect race. So the good news is you're going to learn from every race that you ever do.
Right. Hopefully.
I've seen people
who I have talked to extensively go out and do the same thing over and over again and still not understand it. This is a great comment. I had this guy that I was, you know, working with, and really young, real strong, just an amazing boy. Oh, if I could have a pair of legs like that and an engine like that. And he calls me after his first race.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just a training race, but he said, so I was winning the race.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Bad thing to tell me. Don't tell me you were winning the race. And he goes, no, you don't understand, Ron. I was winning the race. He said, I was way stronger than all those guys were. It was unbelievable. I was out there on front. I was just like, you know, they couldn't come around me. I was winning the race. And then all of a sudden, they just left me at the end. And I went, the only time you're winning the race is when you cross the line before everybody else does. Then you're winning the race. But you know what you were doing? You were being used. And you didn't even realize what was happening. So I had to have a conversation with him about that and how this is a really good thing you did because you just learned something from it.
Yeah, it's tough because when you look at other sports like track racing or swimming, when the gun goes off, the goal is you just go as hard as you can from the gun.
Right.
And whoever is ahead at any given point in the race is winning the race.
Right.
But bike racing is so different because...
Oh, there's so much more to it.
The only thing that matters is the order in which you cross the line. So if everybody in the race decides to noodle or stand still or even unclip at some point, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter who's leading the race at any given point. It doesn't matter the speed of the race at any given point. It's right. All about the strategy. And the strategy is completely centered on... crossing the line first.
Right. Think chess.
Exactly.
On wheels.
Yep.
That's why I always explain it to people that way. Think of the game of chess. Now put it on wheels with speed.
Mm-hmm.
and that's what bike racing is.
Yep.
It's just this, it's a very heady sport in many ways. Very, very heady. So we're going to, when you contacted me actually about, hey, I want to be on the show, you said something about wanting to be on with the idea that we're going to talk about skills and techniques in cycling today. Is that we're still on for that?
Oh, so for sure. Yeah.
I thought maybe this would segue into that because of, you know, we're talking about your first race experience, first group ride, and because, you know, we all have gone out and we've all made our mistakes and we've all learned along the way. And then somewhere along the line, we run into an Amber Pierce or a Ron Meneza that goes, hey, try this, try that, try this. So,
yeah.
But you have far more experience with this than I do. So let's talk about skills and techniques. Tell me what you want to talk about.
Well, last time I was on the show, we started to talk a little bit about riding in a group and riding with other people, and we got a couple calls saying that this was really interesting, helpful stuff. So mm-hmm. That was kind of what I was thinking, is let's see if we can continue that and come up with some stuff that might be helpful for folks who are listening in. Yeah, I think around here, I mean, the first thing to keep in mind when you're riding your bike anywhere is safety. Mm-hmm. Safety is number one. You know, I'm a professional bike racer. My number one goal is still to live to race another day in every race, you know? So, I mean, not to put it in too blunt of terms.
Well,
but,
no, that's fairly accurate.
But I mean, yeah, you don't want, I mean, riding bikes is fun. Racing bikes is fun. So you want to do it safely. You want to be safe for yourself and safe for the people around you. And I think that those are the big things. And so just starting there as a jumping off point, I think, how do you be safe? And last time we were talking about what makes a good wheel.
Oh yeah.
So kind of getting back to that, if you're in a group of riders with friends, whoever it might be locally, if somebody in the group is a really experienced rider, a great thing to do is get on their wheel. And get on their wheel means you want to be the one that's following their wheel as opposed to somebody else's wheel in the group. And watch what they do. I mean, they're going to be smooth. They're going to point out obstacles for you. Make observations about the things that they do, and then if you're not sure why they're doing something, ask them. But you know, you really can't go wrong mimicking what they do if they're a solid, experienced rider. And that's you know, picking the good wheel in the group. And then the follow-up question of that is, how do you be a good wheel? And again, that goes back to the safety aspect. And the number one thing is to be safe on the bike for you and others is to be predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So
very much so. Yeah.
You know, you don't want to have any sudden acceleration, sudden stops. You don't want to have any sudden lateral movement. If you're going to move laterally, if you're going to slow down, signal your intention. It's just like driving a car. You wouldn't just swerve across eight lanes all of a sudden with no signal. You would plan ahead. You would signal. You'd let everybody know what you're going to do. So I think those are some really good starting points.
And a thing that comes off of this too is that if you become that wheel, that good rider like that, when a vehicle, a motorized vehicle comes around you and a person is driving that, it's easier for them to get around you. Yeah. If you're not wiggling all over the road.
Right.
And you're predictable. Yep. And you're telling them where you are and what you're going to do. It's a communication thing. And I talk about this all the time with people about it's all about communication, proper communication. And I'm not talking about yelling out this and yelling out that when I'm going along. I've been in enough situations like that in Cat 4 races that, boy, it's really chattery in those. But when you move your way up and all of a sudden now you find yourself with that lovely number 2 on you and on your license, and you realize that everybody, no one talks. I mean, the only thing they talk about is, hey, how'd you do last weekend? You know, what's going on with the family? How's this? How's that? They talk like that, but they don't, you know, they don't like say hole or sand or start screaming out or, you know, hold your, you know what line, you know, that all kind of disappears when you get up to that level, because there's a communication that happens without talking. You know
well,
what
that's
I mean?
In a race, right?
Yes.
In a race scenario. On
a group ride, you may need to chatter a bit.
You might need, I mean, group rides are meant to be social. So there might be
right.
some, I mean, there ought to be some conversation. And it's, you know, certainly acceptable to be vocal. And sometimes on a group ride, since people are chatty and a little bit more social, it's actually good to be vocal because, you know, you may point out a pothole, but the person behind you might be glancing at the person next to them in conversation and not see you point out the pothole. So calling out the pothole on a group ride in a social situation is not the worst idea, just because that audible cue in addition to the visual cue can help increase the safety for the group.
Okay, that's good.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
He often complains, it sounds like a cat four race here. And
cat
I'm like,
five now, but yeah.
Whatever, cat. Yeah, it sounds like a cat five race here. Yeah, there's women's cat five now?
No, just men's.
Four.
Just
that's
men's.
What I thought.
Four
yeah.
for women, five
yeah.
for men.
Yeah, and I'm like, you know, the more information, the better.
Yeah.
And it's, as you said, in a group ride, it's not so focused, so
right.
people could be looking away. I don't see a problem with yelling pothole.
No, I actually rode with a former coach of mine. He'd snap his fingers and then point. Which was great.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Get your attention.
Yeah.
And then you would see where he's pointing. Because, I mean, even if we weren't chatting and I'm behind him and I'm just on his wheel and I don't have anything to look at but him and his wheel, I mean, I glance up and take in the scenery, or I might be looking at my computer or
yep.
like digging a snack out of my pocket.
Gets your attention.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, I like that. That works. I just want to ride my bike, and I do want to talk to you about, you know, how's it going? How's life? You know, this is why I ride my bike. I ride my bike because I love the social activity that goes along with the bike, and I can be out and I can go out and I can ride, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 miles or whatever it is with you, and not even realize I did it because I've just been having this great interaction.
Yep.
Which is another reason why I ride my bike. There's a social thing to it that's really a very important component. The other thing that I tell people, and this is especially as you start getting in tighter situations, maybe you're working a pace line,
mm-hmm.
maybe you got, you know, elbow to elbows, you know, that are coming in. I always tell people to ride your bicycle like everyone else's life depends on it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the many lists on Ron's rules that
Ron's
I have.
Rules.
I have a lot. Yeah,
I love it.
Fran will tell you about Ron's rules. I have a lot of things that I'm rather particular about.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the best way to put it. But it's all based on years of experience, years of picking friends up off the road,
mm-hmm.
and also, you know, just trying to be safer for everyone, because it's really safety is the key here. You're a moving object down the road. You're not just, you know, it's not like you're out for a walk. You're actually moving. You're going to be moving at anywhere from, you know, 10 to 30 miles an hour, or if you're going down a hill, possibly even faster. And you know, things come at you real quick.
They do. Yeah, they do for sure. And I think for a lot of people who, let's say, are transitioning from a spin class to, hey, maybe I want to ride my bike outside. It can be really challenging and intimidating to think about negotiating traffic and other bikes and other vehicles on the road. So one of the things that I always tell people to do is practice riding with one hand, you know, and you can do this just in your neighborhood on a safe road where you feel really comfortable. Because what you want to do is you want to get to a point where you feel really comfortable signaling your intentions. So signaling if you're going to turn right or left,
mm-hmm.
Pointing out obstacles for the people in your group who might be riding behind you. And I also like to do that just because it helps you wave just wave at people. Wave at other riders, wave at other cars. I find...
You wave at everyone.
I do.
You
do.
You do. It's I talk about that all the time. Amber talks to everyone. She waves to everyone. She waves to cars. She waves to people that are working in their yards. You just, and I know why you do it. I totally get that, because that person could be driving a car or a truck someday.
Yeah.
And they'll remember the nice person who smiled and waved at them a lot easier than they will them being in their way.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
It just changes. You said something very insightful to me when I first had you on, and you said something about stop talking about motorists and cyclists, start talking about people who drive cars and trucks and people who ride bicycles.
Yeah.
And it humanizes the whole situation.
It does. And, you know, I wave at everyone. And I tell you what, 90% of the cars I wave at, I get a wave back.
I do too. Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. And, it's a safety thing, but it's also just a nice acknowledgement of like, hey, neighbor.
Right.
How's it going? Well, here we are. Sharing these beautiful roads. And,
right.
You know, it says all of those things in one nonverbal gesture, which is so nice. And there are so many cars that pass safely. And in Connecticut, the law is you need to give cyclists at least 3 feet. You can go into the lane of oncoming traffic to pass them, and you wait until it's safe to do so. And the cyclist's responsibility is to ride as far to the right side of the road as the cyclist deems safe. And that language was actually changed not that long ago here in the state of Connecticut.
A year ago last July, I think. Mm-hmm. We are in July. Are we in July? We're in July.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about a year ago.
Yeah, love to just wave at people. And in the warm weather, it's really nice because people drive with their windows down so they can actually hear you when you yell thank you. But I really like to acknowledge people for taking the time to pass safely. And most motorists do, or I should say people in cars, most people driving cars do. And I just, it's nice. It's nice to reinforce that and to let them know that you're grateful that, hey, you know, I appreciate that you took the time to see me and waited an extra 2 seconds to make sure that we all can use this road safely together.
Yeah, I even say thank you to the poor person that got stuck because someone made a bad decision behind me and decided to go head on into them. And so they had to stop and pull over and wait for that vehicle to get around them. And I usually shrug my shoulders and go, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, like, I get it. I see what, you know, that you were right and they were wrong. But, you know, anyway, I wave to... If I've had a vehicle that's been sitting behind me for a long time because of, you know, road conditions, whatever, can't get by because this car's coming the other way, when they finally do go around, I always give them a big wave when they go by me.
Yep.
And I even sometimes will give them a wave and then a thumbs up like that just to let them know that they did the right thing.
And often they'll wave back or give a nice friendly honk. And, you know, sometimes if I'm in a situation like that too, and, I'm usually going out for training. So I have specific intervals to do. I need to get a certain amount of time in. I'm trying to get a certain power average, whatever it happens to be. But I'll just pull over and stop. You know, it's 5 seconds out of my workout to let somebody pass and make sure that everybody can be safe. And, you know, I think about how many times cars have waited for me, you know, for a safe place to pass. And if it just looks like, hey, we're coming up through a real curvy section and it's a narrow road. There's not really going to be a good spot of visibility for them to pass me safely coming up. I'll just pull over and wave them around. And usually people are grateful and give a nice friendly honk. But, you know, I mean, what does it cost me to do that?
It's killing your average speed. Oh, my God. I mean, people get so freaked out about that. It's like, well, you know, my average speed, I got to keep moving because I know people. This will drive you nuts, but you probably know them too, who will actually, if they know that they have to stop, they don't have a pause on their computer, on their bicycle, they'll stop it so that they don't ruin their average speed on their ride. Can you believe that? So if they're climbing up a hill and they're out climbing everyone else and they get up to the top of that hill and they have to wait for 30 seconds or so for the rest of the riders to come, they'll stop so they don't hurt their average speed. That's a little edgy, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, why? What? Who are you? Are you the world champion? Are you, you know, who are you? What is your point? You're a bike racer. You have merit to it. It's part of your training. Mm-hmm. I understand it. But the average person who's just out, I get, you know, it's one of those things that makes me roll my eyes.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a great opportunity to do some myth busting.
Okay, go.
I was on a ride with some folks not that long ago, and somebody was asking me, we were going up a climb, and they said, you know, so what would be your average speed on a hill like this in a race? And I realized, you know, this is maybe a really common misconception. And again, going back to this concept of in a bike race, there's a lot of strategy going on. So no one is going as hard as they can from the gun. And I never do a training ride where I just go as hard as I can for 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it happens to be. I never do that.
No.
So, people ask like, well, what would be your average speed for a training ride? I have no idea. And I couldn't tell you what my average speed would be for a bike race until the bike race is over, because you don't know how the strategy is going to play out in the race.
Exactly.
So on any given climb, we might be going berserker because somebody's just attacked and the whole field is chasing him down. Or we might be soft pedaling so much that people might are on the verge of tipping over.
Right.
Because, you know, there's a break up the road and everybody's happy with it. So
nobody cares to chase it down at this moment. So it's no big deal.
Right. So, you know, as a professional rider, I pay attention to a lot of metrics when it comes to my training, but average speed is not one of them.
Right.
And part of that is because most of my training is interval training. So I'm taking rest intervals between my efforts. Part of it is just the fact that average speed is a pretty unreliable indicator because there are so many things beyond your control which affect it. The temperature outside is going to affect the air density. Your hydration status is going to affect how well you're riding. The wind direction, the wind speed, what the traffic is like. Maybe there's construction. There's all of these things that can affect it. And I understand the desire to have a benchmark so that you can track your progress.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you have a certain loop that you do or maybe one stretch of road that you can test yourself on, that might be effective. But just having an average speed for a ride, because the average speed of one route is going to be really different from the average speed of another route. Like if I were to go out and do a 30K ride on one loop and hold exactly the same consistent power the whole time, going as hard as I can, for example, and then I were to do that same exact power output on a different 30K loop, the average speeds would be different.
It's going to be different. Different terrain,
right.
Different anything. All different factors.
All everything,
yep.
That you said.
And,
yeah.
And Franny, please don't take this the wrong way, but do you know how much I love this woman? what you're talking about.
Oh, right.
You know what I'm trying to say here. You're preaching to the choir with me, but this is something that it just infuriates me about people on bike rides, about how they feel like they have to be at a certain place all the time. And it's like, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't. Unless you're like you are, specifically training for something, and it's something you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be putting out 225 watts that day or whatever it is. You know, I'm just picking a number.
Yeah.
I don't know what your wattage is. I'm sure it's far, far higher than that. But
well, even
anyway.
So, if you have an interval, if I have an interval workout, and like I have one of my interval workouts is like two sets of 20-minute pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, if I do those 20 minutes on Route 89, I might get a different speed than if I did them on 198, just
exactly.
Because the terrain is different. And like you said, how hydrated I am, how hot and what the temperature is, whether there's wind in my face or not, those are all going to affect that speed. And the average speed of the whole ride is ridiculous because, like you said, you're going to if I have to have a rest between those 220 minutes, I'm going to go as slow as I can.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Bring the average speed way down.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, kind of going back to this, if you want a benchmark, the best thing to do is to pick a section of road, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
A segment.
A segment.
Right.
And pick a segment that doesn't have stop signs or stoplights or turns, because that way, you know, you don't have to, you're not tempted to run a stop sign to get your average speed up. But go out and test yourself on, you know, pick a spot that works for you, test yourself on that spot and let that be your benchmark. And yeah, if you want to go for average speed on a ride just because you want something to shoot for, great. But always keep in mind that your safety has to come before that. And your safety in terms of, you know, stopping at a stop sign, making sure that you let other cars go, but also the safety of other cyclists in the sense that everything that you do on your bicycle is going to represent to people in cars all other people on bicycles in the area. So what you do on your bike is going to reflect on the rest of us who are also riding bikes. And just keep that in mind. You want to be a good ambassador for everyone in the community.
Absolutely.
And there's another thing I want to point out. People will do things. They'll push themselves really hard to the point where they injure themselves, that they'll do the work so hard, or they'll use poor bike handling or poor methods and then put themselves into injury just so they can go fast.
Yep.
Right. So let's back up on that one. That's a great, great point you make right there. So I always tell people, and I'm pretty strong about this statement, is I have a lot more respect for someone who is honing and has good skills on their bike than someone who goes fast.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't care how fast you go. But if you can ride your wheel, you can ride a real straight wheel, and if I can come up right alongside of you, I can put my arm around you while I'm riding along, and I don't worry about you. I have a rider who has just made it into that club with me. You know, it takes a long time for me to go there. But he's riding really strong, and he had a great ride last weekend. We had a really nice ride. We're coming down 89, and, you know, he's strong, he's straight, he's predictable. He's got everything that you want in a good rider, and he has developed over the years, and he's getting a lot better. So I just went up to him, and I put my arm around him, and I just started talking to him. I said, "You okay with this?" And he goes, and I said, "Just relax, just you're doing good," and just got real tight with him. You know, handlebar to handlebar tight mm-hmm. with him, and just talk to him about how much he's improved and how impressed I am with that. And it's really cool to see the development of that rider, because that's the rider I want to ride with,
mm-hmm.
because he's not going to take me down.
Right. Goes back to being a good wheel.
Right. It's back to being a good wheel. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. And, you know, that point of hold your line, for anybody listening, what that refers to is, you know, in the beginning we talked about the number one thing is be predictable. So if you, you know, you want to avoid any sudden lateral movement. So if you're not moving laterally on your bike, that means you're following the line of the road. So mm-hmm. if you're riding towards the right side of the road, your line, the line that your bike is going to follow will be predictable to those around you.
Right. Right. And I never change my line. And when, if I'm in a turn, I just, you know, this is where I am. I'm not going to change that line. So if you see yourself in trouble, then you need to maybe rethink that the next time. But don't change your line, because you're going to hurt somebody. You're going to take somebody out.
Not suddenly. I mean, there's you know, if you see an obstacle coming up, maybe there's a grate on the side of the road.
You may straighten out a little bit and then go back into your turn.
Right.
You know,
but
just
the point
a hair.
Is you
want to
just look ahead. And if you notice that grate is coming up and you're going to have to move out a little bit, you can signal that if you're looking ahead far enough. So that's another thing, is scanning far enough ahead that if you need to come off your line, move laterally or slow down, whatever it happens to be, you have time to signal your intention to those around you.
Right. I will even, you know, go as far as, and I don't like to do this, but sometimes I do, and that is if I am in a situation where, you know, some rough road is in front of me and I could swerve around it real quickly, but I know I have a lot of people behind me, I just ride through it.
Mm-hmm.
I just ride through it. I don't change my line, because changing my line and swerving is going to cause a lot more of a problem behind me than it is if I just ride through and then a few other people hit the hole and go, "Hey, what's going on?" You know, it's safer.
Yeah.
To me, it's much safer. So, and I'll go, "Oops, sorry."
Well, it can be. And if you know it's coming, you can just warn everybody behind you, like,
"Yep, but
big hole, it's coming up, here we go."
But I'm not going to change my line.
Yeah.
I'm not going to change my line and risk everyone else's life. So I'm just not going to go there. There's, you know, riding, geez, just riding predictable. It makes a huge difference.
It does.
So how do you develop those skills?
Well, again, like I said, the first place to start is learning to ride really comfortably one-handed. And the way that you do that is you want to be sure that if you take one hand off the bar, that you can still ride in a straight line.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you don't want to be signaling a turn and then swerving out into the lane as you try to do that. So that's the first step. Second step is to go out and ride with other people. And I strongly suggest riding with other people who are really experienced. So they, you know, again, you can kind of look at what they're doing, ask them questions, mimic what they're doing. And learning, you know, if you're on a good wheel, you can learn to get closer and closer to their rear wheel, which means that you can take better and better advantage of their draft, which is a big joy of group rides, because speaking of average speed, you can ride a lot faster if you have a group of people together where some of them are drafting and then you're taking turns being on the front and doing more work,
sure.
Which is a lot of fun. And again, the goal isn't a high average speed. The goal is just to have fun, and right. it feels good to ride fast.
It does. It feels great.
You don't have to necessarily quantify it, but you can feel it, and you can just enjoy it for what it is.
Well, there's nothing more that's so much fun as, you know, just screaming down a hill. You know, I love it. And you know, I took you on that two bridges ride one mm-hmm. time, and we went down that road, Grosvenor Road, which drops down and then does this left hand turn, and then the left hand turn doesn't stop.
Yep.
It just keeps going and going. And I tell the story to people all the time about how, you know, just I said something to you, there's a really tricky turn down here, just so you're aware.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into it, and I assumed that you would be following my wheel, but no, you were right alongside of me, and I'm thinking, oh, that's not the line. That's going to be it. And then I went, it's Amber. She knows what she's doing. And you did, and you rode right out of it, but you did comment to me about, ooh, that's a little tricky. I said, yeah. It's better over here. But, you know, it's, you know, you start to learn how to read roads, too. That's another mm-hmm. technique. How do you do that? You do that with time in the saddle.
Yeah.
And I, as you said earlier, find that experience. Cyclist, you know, we've got a guy here who was on the Olympic team and tracking on the track back mm-hmm. in the 60s, and I mean, he's just great to ride with because yeah. you know, you can just see him do things that other people can't. He's very comfortable on his bike,
yeah.
and he's really good at it, so he's a lot of fun. Shout out to Pat Bow. Anyway, yeah, find that person who's got that experience. And I have a friend, my friend Doug, who said he has learned more when he started riding with me. He learned more by sitting on my wheel than anything, any other. He's a very wise man too. He's
yeah.
just, you know, he picks stuff up, and then he would come up and he would ask me questions. Why do you do this? Why do you do that?
Right.
And then I'll explain it to him, and he's right on it after that. And he's telling everybody else how to do stuff then.
That's great.
So it's really cool. It's really cool. I lost my mic there for a second. It's cool when people learn, but other techniques that I like to do, I like to tell people about the one-legged drill.
That's a good one.
I think that helps, and you can add to that.
Yeah, so one of the things that over time you'll end up developing just naturally is what we call pedal stroke smoothness. So a lot of times when people get on a bike, they'll kind of stomp on the pedal. So if you think about it, you're pedaling your foot around a circle, and so a lot of times I think most people's instinct to begin with is to really push hard down on the pedal, but you don't necessarily pull through the bottom of the pedal stroke and up over the top of it, completing the whole circle. And so when you have a really smooth pedal stroke, you can actually pedal really nicely, really smoothly with even torque all the way through that circle that your foot makes with the pedal. And you can do that both with your left leg and your right leg. And eventually, by just riding a ton, your body will learn how to optimize your pedal stroke. But you can also accelerate that process by doing one-legged pedal drills. So that would be just leaving one foot unclipped and pedaling with the other leg alone, which is really, really hard to do. So you want to do this on a nice flat road. Or a slight grade if you have it.
Like a 2% grade is perfect.
It's good. And then if you find that it's really hard to pedal over the top of the pedal stroke when you're just doing the one-legged, you can also put the other foot back in the pedal and then just kind of let it not do any work, but it can serve as a counterweight so that it's not quite so stressful for the other leg. But just focusing on pedaling only with one leg at a time is a great way to improve your efficiency and your pedal stroke.
And you get less wiggly on your bike when you do it. When you get become much smoother. I preach this one. This one's pretty important to me because I think it really works.
It does.
There's no question. I hate it when I have to do it on a 2% grade
mm-hmm.
because it burns. I mean,
it does.
Really, really hurts. But it does make you a better cyclist. So here we go. I mean, God, we just burned through the time so quickly. this has been great. My guest today has been the lovely Amber Pierce.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, my local professional bicycle racer here who so kindly came in today to talk to us about everything bicycles and mainly, though, about technique. And hopefully people have learned something out there from this. And are you around for a little while? Or are you off to the races again?
Leaving on Monday for a stage race in Bend, Oregon.
Oh, Bend. Oh, have you been to Bend yet?
Yes, many times.
Oh, isn't that the coolest place?
Yeah, actually, the race is the Cascade Cycling Classic, which has been around for, it's been a staple on the calendar for a long time. It's one of my favorite races.
Oh, I want to be you. Okay, well, that's cool. That's totally cool. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
And you're just out there for that, and then you come back?
Yep.
Look me up. We'll go for a ride.
Sounds good.
Let's do that. Speaking of rides that are coming up, just a reminder here, the Thread City Cycler Century is Saturday, July 29th, 2017. That is, there's a 102-mile ride, an 84-mile ride, a 66-mile ride, and a 43-mile ride, and you can find out about that at threadcitycyclers.com. The Steeplechase Bike Tour is coming up on August 19th, 2017, and there's a 5-mile walk, or you can choose to ride it if you wish, a 20-mile ride, a 35-mile ride, a 50-mile ride, a 62-mile ride, or 100 kilometers, and a 100-mile ride. This is the 26th year of that particular event. We'll have more information on that as we get closer to it. And you can find that at www.steeplechasebiketour.com. And then on September 16th, 2017, the new Ashford Metric Gravel Grinder presented by Nerac Earth Cycling Club. And that can be, you can find them at nerac earth cycling.com, I believe, or maybe it's .org. I'm not 100% sure on that one, so you might have to look for it. But anyway, that is going to be a gravel grinder, 62-mile gravel grinder, or mostly gravel roads is what they say.
Good times.
So fun stuff. So Amber, thank you again so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Always a delight to have you here. My name is Pedlin Ron. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, the lovely Fran Storch. Shout out. No, she's
hi.
Not there. Oh, there she is. A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you wish to contact me, you can contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you would like to contribute to be on the show or as a guest, or you have something else you need to contribute to us, please contact me again at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedlin Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike.